I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. This is Kirstjen Nielsen's last day as Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. She reportedly locked horns privately with the president and White House aide Stephen Miller over immigration policy. She came close to being fired by President Trump several times because she was not tough enough about stopping the influx of migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border. Publicly, though, Nielsen was the face and voice of the Trump administration's tough treatment of immigrants. Here she is on Monday speaking to reporters in front of her home.
I just want to thank the president again for the tremendous opportunity to serve this country. I share the president's goal of securing the border. I will continue to support all efforts to address the humanitarian and security crisis on the border. And other than that, I'm on my way to keep doing what I can for the next few days. So thank you all for being here.
Here she is on March 6th at a congressional hearing denying that the administration had a policy of separating children from their families.
There is no policy of family separation. What we did was increase the number of parents that we referred for prosecution. That is what we have done for the last three administrations.
Thank you.
That was not true. There was a zero-tolerance policy of family separation, and President Trump reportedly wants to bring back a version of it. Well, we asked Aswin Subsang to join us. He's White House reporter for The Daily Beast. And Aswin, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Was Kirstjen Nielsen fired? Did she quit? What led to her leaving her job?
Well, the technical term is resigned, but when the president of the United States essentially forces you to resign, there's no other honest way to describe that besides firing or an ouster or a dismissal or whatever fancy or not so fancy word you want to call it. But what led to her getting sacked earlier this week was that the president of the United States, Donald J. Trump, for many months, as you mentioned earlier during this show, had been flirting on and off with firing her or ordering her firing because he didn't feel she was, quote unquote, tough enough on the border or migrant caravans or undocumented immigrants or asylum seekers. And this had been going on for a long time. People close to the president, including Fox Business host Lou Dobbs, who is a hardcore anti-immigration hardliner, had been whispering into the president's ear, both through the TV and in private phone calls, as we reported at thedailybeast.com earlier this week, that she had to go.
What precipitated her being let go?
Well, what precipitated her being let go was in recent weeks, the president of the United States had asked Kirstjen Nielsen to do things that she interpreted as flat out illegal with regards to the border, including shutting down ports of entry, including to people who were legally seeking asylum in the United States via the southern border. And this was something that made the president absolutely furious and was, as one senior White House official described to us, the quote unquote last straw in his fury towards Kirstjen Nielsen. And senior White House advisors such as Stephen Miller, who is another very anti-immigration, both legal and illegal, hawk working in the administration, had been telling the president repeatedly over the past many weeks and many months that he should get rid of her, that she was not the right person for the job, and reinforcing the president's already anti-Nielsen instincts on this. Now, the important thing to remember for your listeners is that it's sort of hard to define, and I'm not even sure if the president himself knows exactly what it would take for someone to be tougher than Kirstjen Nielsen on this question of the border in recent weeks and legal asylum seekers. The president of the United States and people close to him who agree with his instincts on this would just want the DHS secretary to straight up break the law and violate international agreements.
Well, let me just follow up on a couple of those. And we have a little bit of a technical problem. I'm not sure how serious it is, but I'm not sure that you can hear me. But I just want to make sure that you can. But even just picking up, what would you say is the legacy then of Kirstjen Nielsen? And we should say that she was a protege of the former White House chief of staff, and it seemed that as long as he was there, and he left at the end of 2018, that she was more vulnerable, it seems, in her position.
No, absolutely. She was definitely more vulnerable after former White House chief of staff John Kelly left, but she was already plenty vulnerable while he was in there. And also, to your point in your question of what do I think, as someone who covers Trump world and the White House day in and day out, what will Kirstjen Nielsen's legacy be at the end of the day, is that she wasn't just the public face of some of the administration's more draconian immigration policies, such as zero tolerance and family separation, but she was, at the end of the day, a willing administrator of those very policies and public defender of those. There are plenty of reports about her sort of resisting and slow walking and questioning some of these things, but at the end of the day, she did them and didn't resign in protest. So she was a willing collaborator with President Trump and his other anti-immigration elements in his administration on this, and that will be following her for a long time. And the fact that she sort of sheepishly objected to them from time to time, I don't think makes that much of a substantive difference.
Well, let me pick up on a couple of things. And you mentioned Stephen Miller, and his name has appeared in a number of reports about what has been happening with immigration policy at the White House. You describe a quote-unquote cold war of backbiting and paranoia between Stephen Miller and Kirstjen Nielsen, I guess, over this, what the Trump administration's immigration policy was or was supposed to be. Help us understand how personal that was, how political that was.
Sure, absolutely. On the purely personal level, the people who we interviewed for that story that you just referenced said that it, in numerous Oval Office and cabinet room meetings during the Trump era, it was straight up uncomfortable and awkward to be in the same room as Nielsen and Miller, because there was an open mutual disdain and disgust and distrust for each other that neither of them bothered hiding. In private conversations with their own allies and confidants, Nielsen would lambaste Stephen Miller as a nut job who hated brown people. I'm not sure if she used those exact words, but that was definitely basically precise gist of it. And Stephen Miller distrusted Nielsen for a long, long time as a bushy, squishy, moderate or so-called moderate Republican who couldn't be trusted on not only immigration, but to have the president's back and the Trump agenda's back when the chips were down. And on policy, as I mentioned before, people like Miller and also President Trump himself would have liked it if this DHS secretary had gone behind measures that would have been in contravention of U.S. law and international agreements. So at the end of the day, that is a core of this and something that I'm not positive if people like Miller or Trump appreciate fully, how their ideal DHS secretary would just over and over and over again get tied up in American courts. Perhaps they grasp that, perhaps they don't fully.
Well, it seems there are probably a number of names. Kris Kobach was one that I saw. But I wonder, is then Stephen Miller essentially, if he's in part the architect of our immigration policy, is he essentially running DHS, even if in an informal way?
President Trump has specifically told Stephen Miller, and this is a direct quote that the Daily Beast and other news outlets had reported based on people we spoke to inside the administration, quote, "You're in charge." He said to Miller fairly recently regarding immigration policy in the administration. Now, does that mean he's shadow DHS secretary? Maybe, yeah, sort of. But I think the adjective you used earlier, informal architect and chief and main driver in the White House of Trump's immigration policies, is basically right and has been right for a long time behind the scenes and at times more under the radar than it's been in the past few days. But at the end of the day, the president of the United States is the driver of his own immigration policy, and he's not being forced or tricked into any of these things. These are his instincts. It's what he campaigned on in 2015 and 2016, and it's what he is, by all measures and accounts, going to keep doing.
Well, Stephen Miller was essentially the architect of the travel ban against citizens from Muslim-majority countries. He favored 10 cities. I'm actually looking at something Michelle Cottle wrote in the New York Times, agitated to end the 20-day limit of detaining migrant children, and goes on from there. And the president said he wants a tough or tougher policy coming from the White House. But as you mentioned, Oswin, he is up against the courts and up against the laws. What do you anticipate?
Well, I anticipate the president pushing pretty sternly with his new DHS secretary and other administrators of his immigration policies over the next few weeks and months to get quote unquote tougher, whatever that means, in the ways that we were talking about earlier, on both illegal and legal immigration to the United States, particularly, if not exclusively, through the southern border. And I predict that what will happen with those policies, if carried out and enacted in sort of the severe and brutal way that Donald Trump would like, is like a lot of his other policies in his administration over the past couple of years, that even ones that had nothing to do with immigration, that got almost immediately tied up in court and places like the Ninth Circuit in the United States. And that then leads to a standoff that potentially makes it to the Supreme Court. And the president is at least self-aware about that. He's talked about that in public before, that he knows some of his more extreme measures, such as the national emergency that he declared regarding the border several months ago, would ping pong between his administration and the courts for a while and perhaps ripple its way up to the Supreme Court. And he expresses a certain degree of frustration, both publicly and privately, about it, but also at the same time, a self-awareness about it. So
I'm looking actually at a tweet here, and it's a looking at our national security leadership, defense secretary vacant, DHS secretary vacant, UN ambassador vacant, FEMA director vacant, Secret Service director vacant, ICE director vacant, DHS deputy vacant. I should say it came from Adam Schiff, but nonetheless, I think it does show a number of vacancies and perhaps even a vacuum when it comes to national security leadership.
Absolutely. And for a president and before that candidate, Trump, who bragged so fervently and thoroughly and prolifically about always hiring the best people and having the best people always want to work with him no matter what, he certainly has trouble holding on to the quote unquote best people and even filling vacancies with them.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Oswin Soopsang, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times. It wasn't the greatest phone line, so we have to end this a little bit short, but thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And he's White House reporter for The Daily Beast. We were talking about the shakeup at the Department of Homeland Security, and this is Kirstjen Nielsen, the secretary of DHS. This is her last day on the job. After this very short break, we'll be talking about U.S. policy in Central America and how it has led in some ways to the migrant crisis along the border. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. There is a crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border with a dramatic increase in the number of migrants seeking asylum in the United States. That's in spite of the Trump administration's policies cracking down on asylum seekers, making them wait in Mexico before having their cases heard, separating children from their parents, and threatening to cut off foreign aid. Our guest, Jeff Foe, wrote in The Nation, "We have trapped Latin American migrants between a foreign policy that drives them from home and a domestic policy that drives them back." We asked him to talk more about U.S. relationship with Latin America, how intervention and policy decisions have exacerbated conditions. Jeff Foh is founding president and distinguished fellow at the Economic Policy Institute. Jeff Foh, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, nice to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I do want to talk about this history, and it goes back more than 100 years. But first, Jeff Foh, what do you make of the fact that I believe in March, something like 100,000 people were trying to get into the United States, some of them seeking asylum, some of them seeking work, probably some of them trying to sneak in as well. But what do you make of the fact that there's this gigantic influx? I think the last time it was that high was something like 2007.
Yeah, the situation in Central America is, for most ordinary people, is just deteriorating like crazy. It's not only poverty and economic deprivations that's driving them, but the violence is getting worse and worse. There's something big missing in the debate here in the United States. It's focused entirely on what we do when they get here, these people. On the one hand, compassionate liberals, and I'm sort of one of those, thinks we ought to help desperate people. On the other hand, forgetting for a moment about Trump and his vile attacks on immigrations, but there are serious law and order conservatives who say, well, this is illegal. And as a matter of fact, many Americans agree with this. They're compassionate, but it's illegal. We should send them back, except for, people who are truly desperate and fleeing from violence.
Right.
The problem is that category is rising all the time. But missing from this debate, the political debate here, is what we have done there that drives them here.
Well, let's talk about some of that history. We could begin maybe 150 years ago. We could begin more recently than that. But since you're here, let's go back to 150 years ago and when the United Fruit Company set up business and the United States looked at Latin America as a place to do business, frankly.
That's right. And looked at it as a place to invest, and we say the United States, we're talking about the American business and American investors. And United Fruit's not the only company, but it was a symbol of U.S. Economic dominance of these countries. And over those years, every time there was a pushback from people, the United States has sent troops, has sent arms, and helped the elites of these countries essentially suppress democracy and suppress mm-hmm. any disturbance of the deal that was going on between American capital and a handful, really, of rich families allied to U.S. business, coffee, bananas, et cetera. But for all of this time, immigration to the United States was relatively modest. People came from Central America, but not in the waves that they're coming now. And then things started to change, first in the 1980s, when Ronald Reagan launched the Contra Wars, the wars against leftists in Central America. The United States flooded the region with guns. The CIA, as we know from the public documents and testimony, had a secret alliance with drug gangs to raise money after Congress had prohibited this kind of activity in Central America. The CIA went down there and raised money in the drug business and bought guns from Iran. There's a whole sordid story about that, but the end result is that we had American money, American guns, and U.S.-trained military for more than a decade committing atrocities and disrupting those countries. 200,000 people were killed in Guatemala alone.
Let me just jump in here only because I want to make sure our listeners know who's talking. And that's sure. Jeff Foe, our guest. He's founding president, distinguished fellow at the Economic Policy Institute. And we wanted to have a better understanding of the migrant crisis and to understand better what might be driving so many people from some of these Latin American countries to the U.S.-Mexico border. And some of our U.S. history and involvement in that region is, I would say, a partial explanation. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me go back even to the 19th century into the early 20th century, when you look at some of the large multinationals that had their businesses in Latin America. Did that, though, represent jobs in any way for people living in those countries?
Yes, it did. And there was employment in coffee and bananas. It was low-wage agricultural employment. But people did earn enough to survive, and you know most people don't want to immigrate. They don't want to leave their home country or their home culture. So as I say, the immigration from there to here was relatively modest, mm-hmm. Because there was a way to make a living in El Salvador and Honduras and Guatemala. So then you had, as I say, the 1980s with the Contra Wars, and then you had NAFTA, which opened up the land route through Central America and Mexico for cocaine coming from Latin America, from Bolivia and Colombia. And that meant suddenly the economics of those countries changed. Huge profits were now available in the drug business. Drugs bring more profits than bananas and coffee. And so the Central American elites became partners of the drug cartels. And at first, same thing happened in Mexico. You know, it was just a business. Well, they, you know, bring drugs in from some Latin America and sell them to the gringos, and you know it was a business, illegal and profitable. But gradually, that kind of business turns into a criminal culture. When drug gangs compete against each other, they don't do it on price; they do it on violence.
And it explains, I guess, the kind of level of violence that we are seeing today. But it looks like it was kind of Cold War politics sort of reacting with or in conflict with, maybe, but also in conjunction with drug policy.
Yes. No, I think and both of those, and NAFTA, which was not drug policy, it was trade policy. It was under the unexpected consequences of NAFTA, which was to open up the land route through Central America and Mexico, which made it to the United States, which made it a lot cheaper to ship drugs from Latin America. They used to ship them up by boat to the Caribbean and up to the East Coast in the United States. So you get that combination. They're different things, but they were all U.S. policy. And then you get the elites there having relationships with the drug cartels, and that morphs into violence, and then it morphs into criminal organizations. Mm. So you have extortion and robbery, we're no longer just a business shipping drugs to the United States, but it's a it begins to have a culture and a business of exploiting their own people.
Well, let me ask, let's talk a bit, if we could, about MS-13. These right. were young El Salvadorans, essentially, that ended up in Los Angeles. This was, I guess, in the 70s, 80s. They became a tough street gang. They took on other gangs. And then under the Clinton administration, essentially sent back to Central America. And it looks like in many ways they took advantage of the fact, the kind of lawlessness that you described, and have found root there.
I think that's exactly right. El Salvador has its own history. with these gangs, and they originated in the United States, in Los Angeles, when immigrants came, and often these were the children of immigrants. Mm-hmm. But then they got deported back to Guatemala, and that's when it morphed and grew into the menace, if you will, that it is today. So you have this situation, and the economics of it, to get back to your point about jobs, the economics of it is that, when you're hiring people for to work in the drug industry, you're not hiring a lot of campesinos to chop bananas and coffee. You're hiring a certain kind of person who is potentially a killer. So these people, and this is common to all those three countries, gradually became protected by the political institutions that the United States continues to support, and that's the point. We have a war on drugs that's been going on for more than a decade, and most of that money is used to keep those elites in power. We supply helicopters, we supply computers, we supply all of this kind of military logistical equipment to help those the militaries. Now, just the great example, the horrible example here is Honduras. Now, in 2009, the elected president of Honduras, one of the elite families down there, decided to do something for the people. I mean, it wasn't radical at all. He raised the minimum wage, some money for education, school lunches, things like that. Well, the elites didn't like that. And one night, the Honduras army, trained in the United States, bursts into the president's palace, takes him out of bed in his pajamas to an American Air Force base, and ships him out of the country, sets up a new government, and the Obama administration, right, the compassionate side of the debate over immigrants, the Obama administration endorses that coup. Last year, the continuing fraudulent election as a result of this army takeover occurred, and the Trump administration, the Law and Order administration, welcomes them. Hmm. There were demonstrations in Honduras. People were beaten. There were at least 12 people killed in the capital. These are the rulers that our policy has been supporting.
Well, let me ask you about yeah. Mexico. Mexico has a new president, I would say a left-leaning president, yes. By his description and other people's as well, Manuel López Obrador. He campaigned on defending the downtrodden. He, frankly and interestingly, has kept kind of a low profile dealing with President Trump. And I was reading an article recently that his kind of open-door policy to migrants coming from other countries through Mexico has exacerbated to some degree the crisis along the U.S.-Mexico border.
Yeah, I think that's those two observations are true, but I would add another one, and that is of all of the actors in this drama, López Obrador understands the basic problem of this immigration, and that is poverty and violence and the economic situation that has created them. On the first point, there's no Mexican president who can ignore the president of the United States. I mean, that country is just too dependent on us. So, he said many times that he's not going to go and get into a shouting match with Donald Trump. It would be self-defeating. His problem now is that he has been much more open and accommodating. He's a person of the left, so he's got sympathies towards these immigrants. And he started in the south of Mexico to provide visas for immigrants coming in. But suddenly, with essentially the wall here between the United States and Mexico in the form of the hardline immigration policies. Now he's got a situation where the immigrants are accumulating in Mexico, especially along the border. And, you know, if you look at the experience of Europe, you know that when you start putting immigrants into encampments, you know, where they can't get out, they can't go forward, and they're afraid to go back, you're just asking for an explosion. So we haven't seen yet what might become the worst part of this story.
Well, it sounds like you're describing, though, the potential for some kind of violence either perpetrated against the migrants or migrants pushing back, essentially, in Mexico?
Both. You know, people get, as I say, learning something from Europe, people get frustrated. The migrants come to the border. They're stopped. There's no decision on them for months and months. And they're now growing in encampments. And the Mexicans, who were very, very sympathetic to them, are now feeling pushback. Mexicans along the border now are saying, wait a minute, you know, our little town is being inundated with these people. We don't have the money to take care of them. So it's a festering problem. And if it could well, as I say, using the European experience, explode. On the other hand, the new president of Mexico does have it right when he says the fundamental problem here is poverty and no opportunities for young people.
Well, you know what? Let's take a very short break, and then we'll pick up on that after the short break. And again, that's Jeff Pho. He's founding president, distinguished fellow at the Economic Policy Institute. And we asked him to join us on Radio Times today to help us understand the relationship between the United States and Latin America and how that could help explain this crisis along the U.S.-Mexico border. Looks like in March, something like 100,000 people at the border looking for entrance, either asylum or entrance into the United States. You can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. And if you're just joining us, Jeff Pho is our guest, founding president and distinguished fellow at the Economic Policy Institute. We called him up to join us to talk about the relationship the United States has had with countries in Latin America. Let me play a clip. This is President Trump declaring on Saturday that the United States is full, not willing to accept any more immigrants.
Our country is full. Our area is full. The sector is full. Can't take you anymore. I'm sorry. Can't happen. So turn around. That's the way it is.
Jeff Pho, we can argue whether the country is full or not. Clearly, it is not. But at the same time, and you have described this longstanding relationship the United States has had with countries like Guatemala and Honduras and Mexico and other countries in Latin America. Is there a need for some kind of a Marshall Plan for the Northern Triangle? That was one of the ideas that I saw floated out there.
Yes, I think there is. I think that the United States, if we're going to solve this thing in the long run, and even I think you could argue in the shorter run, we're going to need a completely different approach to this thing. López Obrador has suggested this, and he's already started it himself. Mexico can't do it himself, but in some projects in the south of Mexico that would bring jobs to Mexicans living there, and it's not a hugely populated area of Mexico, and for Central Americans across the border. Foreign policy is not something that most Americans think of very deeply. And But Americans who do, who are politically active, you know, read the newspapers, the New York Times, the Post, the Inquirer, and the foreign policy is mostly what goes on in Europe and what goes on in China. Every election in some countries that we can't even find on a map is covered. And yet there's very little coverage and very little in-depth thinking about what's going on right at our border and south of that border. López Obrador has suggested as part of his general campaign that we have a Marshall Plan, and I actually written a letter to Trump suggesting that. Now, you know, Trump is not a serious person, so let's leave him out of this this discussion. But yes, that's what we need. But we need more than that. It's more than just more aid. When Trump says we're going to cut off aid, you know, there's a little bit of truth in that, that the aid has been going to bolster the oligarchs that are creating the problem in their own country that comes back here. Someone once said years ago that, you know, a lot of foreign aid is a transfer of money from poor people in rich countries to rich people in poor countries. And that's certainly the case in Central America. So what we need is a policy that says, first of all, no more military aid until your whole system is cleaned up there. And by the whole system, I mean the whole system, the judges, the judicial apparatus, the police. There are good people working there, but they get ignored or they get murdered. And so if we're going to care about this area, and we should, we've got to do something to stop supporting the corrupt governments that are causing the problem.
And I think
you need a Marshall Plan. You need the money. And you know, that area has got resources.
Well, you know what? Let me just jump in here, yeah, only because there are a couple of folks that want to, they've got comments that I want to read as well. But it sounds like what you're describing is, you know, enlightened self-interest, which is, it sounds as this would be in the self-interest of the United States to have at our, sort of like Canada to the north. You don't see people streaming over the Canadian border to get into the United States. But we certainly do see that in the south.
That's right. That's right. And if you're going to get at the root cause, and that is the thing that is driving, again, people don't, you know, don't by nature want to leave home and leave their home country. But if you want to get at the root cause, you've got to get at the economic problem.
Marta says, I'm from Central America, and I think the corruption of Central American governments is a main contributing factor of migrants fleeing that region, which, Jeffro, is what you have been talking about. But getting at corruption, which can be so embedded in a society, and as you said, if it's corrupt people who also have a lot of money and essentially control the country, how do you detangle that?
Well, the first thing to understand is the economics of the elites in these countries is based on the U.S. It's U.S. military aid, it's U.S. support for them at the World Bank, at the IMF. I mean, the one of the deals here has been that Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador give us their vote in the UN, and we support the money and loans, et cetera, that go from the World Bank and the IMF to these places and is captured by the elites. Mm. So that's the rotten thing that happens, and it happens at the top. And it, although it does pervade the society, there's no question about that.
Well, I was reading actually an article about El Salvador and the United States, and the U.S. ambassador to El Salvador is actually a holdover from the Obama administration. This was, I believe, in the New York Times today, saying that it looks like the ambassador working with that government in El Salvador has taken some steps to reduce some of the violence, reduce some of the crime, and that has actually reduced the number of people from El Salvador leaving the country looking for asylum in the United States.
I have no doubt that that's true, but I've been hearing those stories for the last 15 years.
But as you say, if there's not going to be a Marshall Plan coming from the Trump administration, where would that come from? I mean, would it be, you don't want to repeat what United Fruit did, but would it be coming from a business community that might see it in their own best interest?
No, I doubt it. I think there's got to be a change in U.S. policy. And, Donald Trump's going to be president for another year and three quarters, counting the days here. It is something that that number one, the Democrats need to look at and need to develop and need to consider Mexico in this case, López Obrador, as a partner in developing economically this common problem that they have. I mean, it is not going to, obviously this is a longer term solution. It's not going to solve what's going on today. We need massive increases in border processing capacity, judges, hearing officers, decent shelters. You know, we got 850,000 cases backlogged. This represents criminal neglect by this administration. On the one hand, they tell us we got this huge problem, it's an invasion, et cetera, but they're doing nothing to deal with it. Dealing with the short-term pain is going to take money. It's money that I think, because of what we've been doing, we owe these people. Most will be sent back in any event. But if going back means the prospect of more death and violence, they're going to keep coming out right up to the border, and they're going to come over the fence, they're going to come under the fence. So one of the things that needs to be done here is to provide some hope that if you go back, it's going to be into a different place.
Hope and safety and security and some kind of future for your children.
Yeah. There are people in all of those countries, who are valiantly fighting the systems, and signals from the United States that, things are going to change and we're no longer going to be giving aid to your enemies, no longer be giving aid to people who will crush you, I think that's a really important first step.
You know, it's interesting when President Trump threatened to shut down the border between Mexico and the United States, the business community, chambers of commerce, and frankly, many members of Congress said no, because it would essentially stop the commerce that flows back and forth between these two countries. Now, it seems to me that commerce does represent some kind of jobs and hopefully some kind of jobs that provide some kind of future for people living in these countries.
Yes, and it's not like these places are naturally horrible places to develop business and enterprise and economic growth, but they've been completely strangled by this this reactionary social system. So there are resources in these countries, there are resources in southern Mexico. And you can imagine, and it's not utopian, you can imagine the development of these areas with the support of the United States, with the support of progressive people in Mexico and in their own countries, that could transform our future here. But you got to start, you got to start thinking that way, rather than either, open up the borders and let everybody come in because we're compassionate, and that's a non-starter with most American voters, or, doing what we're doing now, which is being cruel and inhuman to people who are suffering.
Here's an email from Paul who says, regarding the, quote, land route opened by NAFTA for drugs, would the better policy be to address the demand here for the product here in the United States? Easier said than done.
Yeah, I can imagine a successful Marshall Plan for Central America better than I can imagine dealing with our own demand for drugs. Although, it's needed, and I think you know, sensible people are trying to work on it, but that also needs to be done. But I think Lopez Obrador is right. Given reasonable alternatives, people would rather not commit themselves to a lifetime of a short lifetime of criminal activity, which is the other thing. You know, these young people going into gangs, like the El Salvadorian gang, like
MS-13,
Maras Lucha. They go open eyes that their life is probably going to be very short.
Yeah.
And this tells you how difficult it is. I was in Guatemala last year and talking to two teachers, and both of them told me that their biggest problem was getting home at night from the school. What are you talking about, says I. Well, they need to take the bus. But too often they get on the bus, and the bus stops, and two or three men come in with guns. They shoot the bus driver, and they rob everybody on the bus. And then the next day, I had a conversation with a young man who was driving a cab part-time. It was the best job he could get. He said he had a master's degree, but he could not get a job in Guatemala if he wasn't connected to one of the five or six families that runs the country. And so he said, my brother borrowed $10,000 to pay a coyote. He borrowed $10,000 from one of the gangs to pay a coyote to bring him to the United States. He came to the United States. He made it. He worked for two or three months, got caught, shipped back to Guatemala. So now he's back in Guatemala. Same situation he was there he was before, plus he owes $10,000. And this is what he said to me. He said, they told my brother, give us the money, get the money, or we'll kill your mother. And then they said, well, if you don't have the money, then you have to work for us. And the job, the first job they sent him on was to give him a gun with two other guys and sent him to rob a bus, just as these teachers
with these children potentially on the bus. I mean, there you're seeing it at both ends, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, why do they come? That's why they come. And it's gotten worse than it was, you know, 30 or 40 years ago because of U.S. policies. Now, it's not the only, you know, life is complicated. It's not the only thing going on. But that's the thing that we're responsible for. And it's about time in our discussions that American leaders and the American press start explaining to the American people our responsibility for this and therefore our obligation to do something about it.
And we're almost out of time here. Is there anyone in the leadership in this country that is speaking the way you are, Jeff Folk?
Well, I think, you know, the problem is it doesn't get into the press. I mean, Senator Leahy, for example, and several members of Congress have understood this for a while. And, you know, if you go on their website or, you know, you read the congressional record, you'll find this expressions of this. But for some reason or other, it gets drowned out in the U.S. egocentric political discussion about what's going on here, right? Not what we did there. And I think that's why I'm on this show. That's why I wrote what I wrote, because we need to get responsible for what we've done. I
mean, well, Jeff Folk, yeah. We have to leave it there.
Oh, okay.
Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for letting me have the soapbox. I appreciate it.
No problem. Founding President, Distinguished Fellow at the Economic Policy Institute. That's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you for joining us.